You're listening to Shared Security, a podcast that explores the trust you put in people and technology. Hosted by Tom Esten, Scott Wright, and Kevin Johnson. Welcome to the Shared Security Podcast, and joining us this week is the OG Security Podcast gangster himself, the great Paul Assadorian.
Wait, does that mean we have to pay him protection money?
Yes. That's exactly what that means.
Damn it.
Welcome to the show.
Hey,
Paul.
It is good to be here. Thank you so much.
Awesome to have you. And it's been a long time since we've actually talked. Like, I don't think we see. Have you been to DEF CON?
I've not made it out to summer camp. However, I did three conferences this year so far that I was speaking at.
Nice.
So starting to get back into the swing of things.
Good. Awesome. Good. I hope to see you at some of the ones I'm going to be at this year.
That would be fun.
I know of at least one that Tom will also be at. I don't remember which one it is, but I'm excited about that.
Yeah. That's the ISC Squared Congress.
Security Congress.
Yes.
Which anybody else always find it funny that, you know, Congress is so productive and ISC Squared has tied their name to it. I also want to know if anybody else is feeling attacked by Paul's shirt, because I'm feeling attacked by Paul's shirt.
So it was a funny story behind this. So you asked me to tell stories. So here's one. I check the mail one day, or, you know, the package comes in and I'm like, I don't remember ordering anything. That's kind of weird. And then you worry that, like, your hacker friends have sent you something. So I open it with great caution. And it's T-shirts. And I'm like, oh, yeah. Like, I definitely had a few drinks one night. And I ordered T-shirts and completely forgot that I had ordered T-shirts. And so one of the T-shirts was never : Q bank. And I was like, wow, I have a good sense of humor when I'm drunk, apparently. That's really funny. Like, drunk Paul is awesome.
Okay, wait. So this is a custom T-shirt you had made.
No, this was from a site. Oh. Yeah, I don't remember one. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just feeling attacked. That's all.
So, to Kevin, do you want to explain why you feel attacked for maybe our audience that can't see the video?
Because I use Q-Bang all the time to get out of VI.
Okay. All right.
That is absolutely something I do. Yeah.
Got it.
And for people who have never used line editors, we should probably say this is just going to be a geeky episode. You may as well hang up now.
This is totally, totally an episode.
We're showing our age.
I'm impressed that Kevin knows how to exit out of VI. But
that's a good point. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but let me be very clear. Don't ask me how to get out of Emacs.
Right.
Yeah. So, I have to tell you about the time I was teaching a class, and I would always say in class that, you know, VI is the best. You know, if you're gonna use something, use VI, Vim, whatever, right? And I had a guy who supposedly, according to him, he was one of the developers that helped build and maintain Emacs. And so he got very upset to the point where on the evals he actually wrote about how it was wrong of me to bash Emacs, which at that point I hadn't bashed it. I just said VI was better. And the next day, like he's talking to me in class and he's complaining about this, that I did this, and I didn't know what to say. So I said, look, I understand Emacs is a great operating system. I was talking about editors.
Wow.
I'll stop now.
Probably didn't help.
So we have Paul on the show. And if you don't know Paul is, and I mentioned this in his intro, an OG podcast gangster, because you are, I think, one of the original security podcasters, are you not?
Yeah, there was only I started my security podcast 18 years ago. There was a handful of podcasts at the time. There's a story that I've told about how it started. You know, used to give a presentation at the university about the latest security happenings that ended.
Yeah.
My coworker Duck Sauce at the time was like, dude, you should do a podcast. And I was like, what's a podcast? And then decided to do a podcast and still do podcasts to this day. And it was interesting.
One of the first podcasts I ever listened to.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you. I was giving the keynote at RVA Sec last week, and I disclosed things about my history that maybe I just hadn't put in quite that way or whatever. And one of the things was, you know, a lot of people have come up to me over the years and said, Paul, the reason I got into security, or one of the drivers for it, was I listened to your show. I'm like, that's amazing. Now, we didn't create the show with that in mind at all. Like, I didn't create the show and go, I want to do this so people get into security. That was just a natural byproduct. We created the show so we could sit around and drink with our friends and talk about security, and really in that order. Right. So
it's, it's true.
I've got to say, I don't. I don't listen to many podcasts. I listen to very few podcasts in this field. I tend to listen to things outside of this field just because of my schedule. And I have always enjoyed yours.
Well, thank you.
And when Tom says you're one of the originals, I'm thinking back. I don't know how many of the ones that I would have thought of 18 years ago that still exist. Except for yours.
There aren't many.
Security Now?
Yeah, there was Steve and Security Now.
Yeah. That was about
they
it.
They still do it today.
Do they count?
Well, I think the other one.
For audience, they do.
And
actually, I stumbled across that show recently because they covered our, at Eclipsium, we produced published research on the Gigabyte vulnerabilities. Cool. And they covered it on that show and went through our blog and read everything, and I was like, that's cool.
Nice. And to be clear, when I say do they count, I'm not bashing them. Your show is different from that.
Yeah.
And that's right. Yeah. And I I'm probably wrong at this. I never thought of them as an InfoSec podcast. I always thought of them as an awareness podcast that happened to talk about
security. Yeah. The audience is different for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, it was, I listened to, Paul.com, your show. I listened to the Network Security Podcast with Martin McKay. Yes. That was the other one that was
exactly
kind of around the same time.
Martin doesn't do that anymore.
No. Yeah.
Long time ago. And that was with Rich Mogul as well.
They're good people. I like them.
Rich is a little short for a stormtrooper, but
there are,
he is a little short for a stormtrooper.
There's a lot of security podcasts today. And
this one,
you can find the ones that I listen to. I actually put them on my website. So recently I spun up a website, securitypodcaster.com is the website. There's an article on there of podcasts I listen to in information security and podcasts I listen to outside of information security. So, because one of the questions I typically get is, what podcast do you listen to? So now I can just go to my website. It's there.
And I also believe, Paul, you and Larry were kind of the founders of the podcaster meetup for quite some time at ShmooCon.
I don't know
where DefCon.
I won't take credit for that. We definitely showed up, though, when we were asked.
Yes, you showed up with lots of alcohol.
We showed up.
I do remember that.
Yes.
Larry had cans of Spam and other things that, Larry would typically bring.
Yes.
Right. Gag gifts and things, but
no, it's funny. You don't even need to say Larry. If you had just said somebody brought cans of Spam, I would have been like, Larry, right?
Well, that's Larry. Yeah,
this is true.
Yeah, awesome, great memories, and I'm really glad to see that you're still at it. And for our listeners and people watching us on YouTube, that is the Security Weekly. I'd say multiple shows, right? I mean, you've got how many podcasts is part of Security Weekly? It's like 4 or 5.
1,330.
I kind of lost track. So in September of 2020, I sold Security Weekly to the Cyber Risk Alliance, and that was so. Before that, I had left Tenable to do Security Weekly full time around 2015, and one of the things I did doing it full time was I started creating new shows. It's a strategy. Right? How do you grow a podcast business? Well, you can do more of one show, which doesn't necessarily open up, lots of new business. So I'm like, well, let's create more shows. And we did that. And I was involved with, I believe, all of the shows as they were kind of getting started. And then my neat trick I would do is I would hand the baton off to someone else. I'm like, this is your show now. I'm going to go create another show. And I did that until I was like, well, that's a lot of shows. And then we were acquired. And I actually created another show while I was there that has not yet been released. So hopefully I've been pushing for that show to be released. But as of today, so I still do Paul's Security Weekly every week, every Wednesday. And in my day job, I'm the principal security evangelist for Eclipsium. And shortly after joining, we created the Eclipsium Below the Surface podcast. So that's my other regular podcast. Nice. Again, if you go to my website, securitypodcaster.com, you'll find the two shows that I do and you can subscribe.
You know that the minute you call yourself a security evangelist, you know the question I have to ask, right?
What's that?
Who is the security martyr?
That's right. It's really just a fancy title to say I talk about stuff. It's really all it is. Yeah.
The net, you're promoted, you're the security prophet.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Good times. So one of the topics that I wanted to talk to you about, Paul, is you've got so many great hacking stories in your career. I've heard over the years on your podcast, I've heard through a lot of the talks that you've given at various security conferences that we've all been able to hang out at. But what are some of your greatest hacking stories? Maybe we start with one, right? What is your greatest hacking story?
Yeah. It's a good question, Tom. I think this one takes me back to the days I was working at the university, and it's probably my favorite one, but for reasons that might not be immediately obvious, because like things came full circle and was really kind of fun and exciting way that story kind of concluded. So I started at working for a local university in 2001. And one of the first things I did, so the university at that time basically had no security whatsoever. They had a couple firewalls, maybe, like no security program, no security engineers. That wasn't even really a thing back then. And so I was hired as a Unix systems administrator with a specialty in security. I would eventually work on the security team and all that stuff. But back then, I was a Solaris Unix systems administrator. And one of the things I got to do was, I'm like, look, let me set up an intrusion detection system. So I set up Snort and started observing lots of things being hacked, coincidentally enough. Because when you hang stuff out on the internet and you don't have firewalls back in 2001, It was good times. And I noticed this one particular attack happening. And I forget all of the details. In fact, at one point, I did dig up the talk I did on this particular hack back in the day. So I noticed like this weird FTP traffic, and I don't know that if it was on a non-standard port or just traffic coming from an area that normally didn't have FTP traffic, or if it was the FTP banner, right? Those were kind of the indicators way back when that we would use specifically in university environments to go, well, that thing's hacked. And I went to the department to sit in front of this particular, it was a Solaris server, coincidentally enough, and, you know, talk to the administrators, they granted me access, and do some basic forensics. And what I found was that folks had compromised this particular server and a couple of servers in a very similar manner. Again, I forget the vector. And they had left some files around. And some of it was their toolkit, some of it was scripts. Inside of those scripts were their credentials for the other FTP servers where they were storing all of their tools and such. I was like, well, that's kind of interesting. This looks like a pretty well-coordinated, albeit not very sophisticated, attackers at the time. I'm like, but this is kind of interesting. And at the time, when there was a cybercrime, I don't think we called it that back then, right, committed, the point of contact that I had was from the Secret Service. So I picked up the phone. I called my local Secret Service representative who had introduced himself to me, you know, a few weeks prior to me, or just as I had started at the university. And he's like, all right, I gave him all the details. He's like, all right, well, that's interesting. I think he even had IP addresses and whatever. He's like, let me call you back. And so he calls me back and he's like, someone from the field office in Italy is going to be calling you. I'm like, oh, okay. What? Like, this is now transpiring like a James Bond movie right now. I'm like, okay, cool. So my phone rings a little while later and I pick it up and sure enough, it's a forensics investigator from Italy. And I told him what I had. He's like, cool. Can you just like PGP encrypt that and email it to me? I'm like, yeah. I'm like, let's do it. So I don't know if he called back or if the local Secret Service agent was like, basically, he's like, they're thrilled with the data that you provided. It like basically broke the case wide open, and they were kind of snickering as to how sloppy, you know, these attackers were. And so I was like, I had basically the keys to the kingdom for this little attack group. And that was the, pretty much the last I heard of it for a while, until I was reading a news article a while later where seven people were arrested as part of this investigation that I had helped give the evidence to, and were tried and convicted. It turned out to be a bunch of sysadmins that had like gone wrong and just started to just like attacking servers and putting wares on there and whatever they were doing at the time. And so they were tried and convicted. I was like, well, that's pretty cool. I gave a presentation at a conference we used to have for academia called MIT Security Camp. And I presented at, you know, all the little bits and, you know, posted a screenshot of the article. And I'm like, that's pretty cool. Several years later, we were sponsored by this company that did incident response. And the founder of that company was also from Italy. And they did a whole sponsorship thing. I interviewed him and the whole thing. And then one day, for whatever reason, I was reading about his background, and he was an Italian digital forensics expert. And I'm like, what are the – I'm like, that was the same person who called me on the phone that day.
Wow. Yeah. Full circle.
Full circle.
Yeah.
Nice.
That's a great story. That's a great story. Now, do you find like kind of the hacks and things you've been involved in your career, have they always been like, oh, I just stumbled upon this and this kind of opened the door to something a lot bigger? Or, you know, how many have been like they were really complex and you had to go through different things and write scripts and like kind of like the things you see like, you know, on TV, right? Like the hacking the NSA database or the firewall from the internet in 2 seconds.
Right? I think, as you guys know, and, you know, most of the audience likely, is that oftentimes it's not very sophisticated. And so, you know, for a while I was running my own pen test company. And, you know, there would be times where I was emails, social engineering and phishing, and I would email them a PDF and they'd be like, oh, I can't open it. I'm like, damn. My exploit didn't work. Like, well, here, try this one and see if you can open it. I'm like, damn, it didn't work again. I'm like, there must be some kind of formatting error. I'm like, try this one. And it worked. And I was like, well, that person just helped me compromise their workstation and played along like the entire time, right? There's other times where I was running Nmap to scan the local environment, and it was a Wi-Fi controller on the network. And just me end mapping it took down the entire Wi-Fi controller, which had the side effect of taking down wireless network access for the entire campus that I was at the time.
Nice.
Not the one I worked for, but a different one. Because after I left the university I worked for, I worked for the consortium that provided services to all of the nonprofits, essentially, mostly colleges and universities in Rhode Island. So, I took down Wi-Fi for an entire campus once. Oops.
Nice. Yeah. I took down an AS400 at a bank through
that
a
could be problematic.
Scan once. Yeah. That kind of sucked. Yeah. Yeah. Take those out of scope. Mm-hmm. Any mainframes. So.
You want your organization to be secure and compliant and to have a healthy culture, but your employees' lack of awareness makes you vulnerable to data theft, fraud, and compliance penalties. It's frustrating that the boring static training content that's being used today has failed to improve employees' ability to defend against cyber attacks. At ClickArmor, we know that without using gamification, it's extremely hard to get staff to understand how to avoid threats. Our gamified simulations and challenges have provided a 50% average improvement in thousands of employees' ability to spot phishing threats. Go to clickarmor.ca/sharedsecurity to get your free gamified phishing assessment for up to 500 employees. You'll see quickly how gamified simulations can help your team be more resilient and compliant and help avoid costly ransomware and fraud incidents. Let ClickArmor help you go from being an underappreciated, stressed out fall guy to being an innovative leader who's the catalyst for greater productivity in your organization.
Now, the other area that you have a lot of expertise in is around firmware, embedded systems, and kind of related testing. Can you talk a little bit about kind of that space right now, or maybe the current state of the security of firmware in general?
You're giggling already, Tom.
I am. Because I can't wait to hear what you're going to say.
And it's interesting. Larry Pesce, who was there at episode one for the podcast, so we've been together 18 years, I guess you could say. We wrote a book together in 07 on hacking WT54G wireless routers. Always curious why everything, there were so many vulnerabilities and ridiculous security controls that just weren't there on those platforms. And so recently, Larry and I went back to work basically in firmware, right? I think we were both kind of at this crossroads in our career. I wanted to work in the industry. I wanted to, you know, leave where the Cyber Risk Alliance to go be in the trenches and work. And Larry was kind of at a similar crossroads. I want to try something different. And we both ended up working in firmware security because that's where our passions still lie, largely because it's still an unsolved problem. Now, I chose Eclipsium for a number of reasons. One, they were a sponsor of the show, and I knew a bunch of people that worked there. So having connections is great. And Eclipsium is solving the firmware problem on the primarily PC servers, laptops, and also network appliances, I would call them as well, which was different from the IoT stuff, which is where Larry works, where the problem is still important, right? But just takes on a different shape, right? The consumer is different. The manufacturers are slightly, you know, different companies producing this gear. So I chose Eclipsium into work in this space because it hits the enterprise, it hits everyone who has a laptop or computer. And what I quickly realized is that there's a whole bunch of little embedded devices or IoT devices inside of your computer, and the story is still the same. Largely, it's pretty terrible security and a pretty complex and terrible supply chain that can present some unique opportunities. Which are the problems that Eclipsium's addressing. So I spent a whole bunch of time actually in preparation before I actually got the job at Eclipsium. Months beforehand, I started going, what's possible in UEFI? And what is that? And then learned that the spec is like thousands of pages long. And there was all this really cool research. And a lot of the people doing that research were either the founders now of Eclipsium or people who worked at Eclipsium. And I'm like, well, that sounds like a really cool place to work. And I became enamored with these issues we have today in firmware that's on your devices, such as things like secure boot and all that stuff.
Yeah. What do you see as kind of some of the solutions for this problem? Because I always look at this as like, just thinking of like updates to firmware. Right. Like the regular consumer still to this day, unless it's being done automatically behind the scenes, you know, they're not going to make the effort to update their firmware, right, to protect themselves from whatever vulnerability, zero day, anything that comes out. What's kind of your thoughts on like where that industry is going to help protect consumers specifically?
Yeah, consumers are an interesting bunch, although I think the part of the solution could be the same as we have for, you know, people who make gear for enterprises. And that's to validate it to a certain standard before it ships. Because we all know once it ships, like you said, the end user's not going to update it. The manufacturer oftentimes will end of life that particular device to go build something new because the new chipset's, you know, a dollar cheaper than the older chipset. And if they're making millions of these devices, like that's a savings. So I think having standards and enforcing those standards is a way to increase the security of these devices once they land. I'll give you an example. So it was Richard Hughes, the founder of the Linux Vendor Firmware Service project, that told me this. And I went and I looked it up, and I actually put it in my keynote that I gave last week. And it is the country of France has a minimum requirements for if they're going to buy a new PC server laptop, it has to meet these requirements. And it can't ship with these ridiculous vulnerabilities or misconfigurations, or they can't buy it. So that's incentive for those manufacturers to go, oh, like we actually have to configure these things securely. Otherwise, we're going to miss out on a contract with an entire country. So I think it's that those incentives, you know, unfortunately, like I like to talk techie and nerdy, but I don't think the big solution here is the techie nerdy side of things. It's really creating the right incentives.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. So many times I see like these webcams that are hacked, right? And they're all from some unknown company in China, and then they're sold on Amazon, right? For $10, and people buy them, and then they're never updated. They don't abide by any standards, right? Because, well, China, right?
Right.
They're kind of doing what they want. Like, how do we get a handle on that? All this cheap, crappy Chinese stuff that comes out on Amazon. That just seems to me like a major issue.
Yeah, that's a trickier problem because the incentives on that scale and that audience are very different. The incentive for the user is they want the cheapest gear possible.
Yeah.
And the incentive for the manufacturers is to produce the cheapest gear possible because people are shopping on price. Mm-hmm. Nowhere in that incentive chain is a more secure device going to help any of those parties involved when we talk about consumer IT gear. So it's hard, and it's also very hard to enforce that internationally. We can't say to another country, like, you can't sell something here unless it meets the standard. I mean, we could try, but like, good luck enforcing that, right? So the FTC has gotten involved and enforced fines on some manufacturers, but I feel like it's not enough. So I don't really have the answer for the IoT side when it comes to cheap cameras and things like that. I think we're kind of you know, out of luck basically when it comes to actually securing those devices.
What do you think about pushing that requirement and or responsibility onto the operating system?
Well, the problem is a lot of those devices. Which operating system are you talking about? They run different chipsets, different processors.
Oh, no. I mean the operating systems of the clients, right? Mm-hmm. If, and I don't know that this is right. It's a random thought process in my head, right? So, but if you said to Microsoft, you said to Apple, you know, we can all fight with Linux. When you connect to a device, it has to meet these standards before you connect to it. That doesn't protect that IoT device from an attacker attacking it directly, but it could potentially cause, you know, Joe Schmo consumer buys a device, plugs it into their network, goes to configure it, and Windows 11 or 12 says, nope, sorry, can't connect to that because of these reasons, right? I see a lot of negative there.
Could be a default setting and you could turn it off, right?
I think I think we tried that with NAC and it largely didn't work.
Oh, that's what I was thinking of NAC.
Yeah.
Well, but NAC largely didn't work because it just didn't work on the network level and required a level of technical skill to implement it, to manage it, control it. That was more of an enterprise thing. I'm literally saying, and I can't imagine Microsoft doing this, right? Like, let me be very clear. I'm throwing out an idea that I can't imagine Microsoft going, yeah, because they've always been known as the company. You can go get an Okadata dot matrix printer and Windows probably has a driver for it. Right. But if Windows didn't let you set that device up, if you're right, you just can't connect to it. It's not supported. It's not. Because the vast majority of these IoT devices require some level of setup by somebody initially, right?
Yeah. If
Microsoft pushed a standard for how to set it up, I don't know. I don't know that it would work. I'm just, what do you think?
I think Google or Microsoft or Apple probably wouldn't do that because it would just make people mad at them. And there's enough people mad at them already.
Yes, there are. Basically. Yeah.
Well, that's the reason to do it is they're already pissed at you. Right. Might as well make them more mad. You know?
But if you're ordering stuff off Amazon and it's a cheap light bulb that's smart, right? I mean, is the light bulb going to say not compatible with the current version of Windows that limits you from connecting with devices that can't update themselves, et cetera?
Yeah, and usually the stuff is configured on your phone too, right?
Yeah. So, yes. Yeah,
that's valid.
Yeah. It's a hard, I mean,
big problem.
Where we had a win outside of the consumer space is with the FDA, right? And again, it was legislation that said, if it has security vulnerabilities, we're not going to approve it as the FDA. I think that was a huge win. Again, hard to have those same stringent standards in the consumer IoT space.
The consumer IoT space is a mess, and it's always going to be a mess.
I think so. I mean, unless we can create an easy way for people to ship things that are secure and it's cheaper.
And this is something we've talked about many times, right? Is that, you know, security has to stop ignoring what the business needs, right? And what you just described is exactly right. If this knockoff hardware manufacturer doesn't have an inexpensive way to build it correctly, right? But right now, there are too many 25-cent network cards that have a built-in web server. I you know, the example I give for that one is I was at the Naval Air Station here in Jax, and they had an event where vendors, providers of services could go in, have a booth and whatever. And I, myself and Andrew were sitting at our table, and across from us was a lighting vendor. And the lighting vendor was like, yeah, we got these great devices. They connect to your network. They can, you know, your airfield to be lit up. You can control them from your phone and everything else like that. And I'm like, really? And I like, it's a web interface. The guy's like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And he says to me, yeah, connect to this wireless access point. And I was bored. So I did.
Oh no.
The entire web interface was in Chinese. And I'm not guessing. Like, this is not Kevin saw Asian lettering and decided it was Chinese. I actually looked and verified it. It was all in Chinese. And I go to the guy and I'm like, hey, you're selling to the U.S. military. That's what you want to do. I have no idea. I want to be very clear. I'm not saying he had active contracts, right? But he's trying to sell to the U.S. military. And the default setting on your lights web interface is Chinese. And his answer was, yeah, you can change that to English. I'm like, I know you can. Right. I get that. I'm not, I saw the little drop down.
Yeah. but you know, the in that context, I think this is also where, you know, standards, guidelines have come into play, specifically for the supply chain, that now if you want to say, if that person wants to sell to the government, they're going to have to attest to the supply chain. And even if they can, if they're going to see it's coming from China, you know, where does the component of your component come from?
You want the bad news? It was in November last year. Now you have to do this. It was 8 months ago, right? Like,
there's been a lot of legislation. But even recently, there's been a lot of legislation passed along those lines. So, which I think is a very positive thing. It's still, I mean, I think the one area we haven't come up with a great solution for is the consumer space, right? As we pointed out, I have interviewed people in the past that I think two different people that have tried to address this problem. One with, I think, like software that ran on your IoT device. I don't know what happened to that company. There's a couple of initiatives that they have a rating system for IoT devices, similar to UL and other things that we have. So when we go to the store and we buy a device, we can go, it's certified by, you know, whatever.
That's a smart idea,
They never really took off, though.
Have you ever looked at UL 2900? I think it's 2900, which is specifically for IoT devices. Mm-hmm. It's a standard, the Underwriters Laboratories. And I find it funny because every single person I ask for in building devices have not heard of it.
Right.
Right. Like, and you would think Underwriters Laboratories could get the word out.
Good stuff. Well, Paul, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Great to catch up. Where can our listeners find out more about you and all the cool stuff you got going on?
Yeah. So I, again, recently put up a website so that people could find just that. So all my social stuff is on there, securitypodcaster.com. You can subscribe to all the socials, my podcasts. There's a couple of cool articles on there too. My PC build, things like that.
Have you started putting the recipes on?
I have not started recipes yet.
I can put a vote in to put recipes out there, because I've seen some of the stuff you've made, they need to be there as well.
I do enjoy cooking. There'll be some tomahawk steaks on the menu this week. So excited about that.
That sounds amazing, actually.
Now I want to awesome. Say.
All right. Well, Paul, thank you very much. And for everyone else, we will talk to you all again next week. Thanks for listening or watching. If you like this episode, please share it with friends and colleagues and subscribe on your favorite podcast listening app. To catch all the latest from the podcast, visit us at sharedsecurity.net. Follow us on Mastodon at Shared Security, on Twitter at SharedSec, and join our Reddit community on the Shared Security Show subreddit.